Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I will be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons into their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. As I prepare to face off for this interview, I can almost hear my guest saying, crouch, bind, set. For sitting opposite me is Alan Lewis, who, when his rugby career was cut short at an early stage with injury, he turned to refereeing with notable success and has refereed at international level at the 2003 and 2007 World Cups. But he's even better known as the third most capped player in the history of Irish cricket, playing 121 times for his country between 1984 and 1997. He is one of only six players to have played more than 100 times for Ireland. Away from the sports field, although he's got a college grade leaving cert, he had no appetite for university, but he did have a genuine interest in following his father's footsteps in the insurance industry. He started with Hibernian Insurance, but within 3 years, the sporting wanderlust took over and he headed off to Australia. An injury brought him home and eventually to LHW, a company co-founded by his father. He focused on the life side of the business and took over for the company when the father and other business partner retired, at a time when the industry was undergoing huge consolidation. Today, Alan is responsible for the strategic development of LHW. Alan, you're very welcome to the podcast, and I promise I won't bowl any fastballs or googlies at you today.
I'd be more worried about the cynical nature you would with the refereeing. I don't want you questioning any of my decisions.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know whether I can guarantee that or not. But anyway, right, let's kick it off. And I suppose a good place to start, when you think about it, is you chose to go the University of Life route, right? Did you regret that at any point?
Not really. Mm-hmm. It was a very firm choice in my own mind. I had kind of an idea, direction. Academia, really, I enjoyed school, don't get me wrong. I was surrounded by some very intelligent people, but I had an idea where I wanted to go myself. Sport was really at the forefront of everything that I did. I had a reasonable leaving certificate. It could have taken me to college. But I kind of look at sometimes things now, and I kind of look at professional degrees. Both my daughters are involved in professional degrees as an example. But arts or things like that, I kind of sensed it might be a waste of time. I wanted to get into the heat of the action from the word go. I wanted to earn some money and I wanted to make a way in my life. And the overall aim kind of in the back of my mind, I didn't know how it was going to work, to be perfectly honest, was that I wanted to work for myself at the end of the day.
But the sporting wanderlust soon took over.
Absolutely. You know, in essence, actually, funny enough, you talked about it. I started my career in Hibernian, who were a very sports fan. At that time, think back 1982, you couldn't get a job. You know, and again, you know, there was angles, obviously the sport piece. Hibernian were very sport oriented. I think they more employed me because I'd play in the cricket team in the sixes in the summer. But
called employing a ringer, I think.
Exactly. Well, though, in those days, those sorts of things happen. And I always remember Jimmy Vaughan, who was the HR director at the time. Now, Alan, this is a great company to work for. You're in the defined benefit pension scheme and you're going to get the... And I'm saying, Jimmy, with all due respects, I don't think I'll be bothered with the DPP. But, you know, it was in my mind. But it was the one thing I learned about Hibernian, it was a great place to work. It had great leadership, and a name that will always kind of live with me was Eamon Walsh. You know, he was the CEO at the time, and he just cared about people. And I kind of think in a lot of organisations now, that's something where you see it in a real favourable sense, it works. But when it goes the other way, it clearly doesn't. And when you're spending 8-10 hours of your life in a place, surely to goodness, what you want to try and do is make people or generate a culture that people are happy coming into work at whatever time they come into work and get their job done. But he really exuded that, and you could feel that people nearly actually wanted to work for him. And it was a very caring organisation. So I spent 3 years there. And then, as you say, the sports odyssey, the dream was to go to Australia and play some cricket.
And you know, that early injury that ended your on the rugby side of it, and probably wasn't great for the cricket side either, but was that a real kind of crisis moment for you in terms of you had kind of set yourself this, or was sport really the only goal. I kind of just said, well, it's a goal for the next while, but I know I can't do it for the rest of my life.
Oh, yes. I kind of think, and it's funny, Evie, look at it in the professional sense now. You know, I felt I was a good cricketer. I learned when I went to Australia, because obviously the standard over there was very strong. I was actually, in our world, I'd say I was very good. Mm. But over there, I actually, you know, performed, because back then, you know, there was a big hullabaloo about, are you in the first? I was told in no uncertain terms, listen, Alan, you're not going to be in the first team here. So I was so hoping I could start in the second team, because it was either you were going that way or you were going west. And fortunately for two-thirds of that, I played first-grade cricket against some test players, different people, and survived, you know, because you were in the lion's den. And that was a great learning exercise for me. But the other part of it was, you very quickly understand that probably in the professional world, realistically, if you weren't playing for your national team, and you could say the same today, if you even look at it in an Irish rugby sense, like, you know, if you're hanging around the edges of professional rugby, there's a hell of a lot of sacrifice, potentially for not a huge amount of return. And that was in my mind always. So in terms of the exit out, it was clear to me probably at that time, when you consider Owen Morgan felt he could play cricket for England. I didn't feel I was going to play cricket for England or go and play county cricket. Playing as a county cricketer then, you were going to earn diddly squat. And I could fulfil a career playing cricket for Ireland and have all the joys of doing that. And cricket really, Aidan, was my passion. Right. Rugby kind of nearly happened by accident, because in essence I came to Winters. And what was I going to do? I'd ruptured my cruciate ligament. I'd had an operation. And a friend, a colleague, actually my father's work colleague, said, look, why wouldn't you just take the whistle and have a go? And I ended up, always remember, first game, De La Salle, Palmerston, up the mountains. And I came away from it and I said, you know what, I really enjoyed that. And that was, I had no ambition, zero ambition. It was literally going to be a vehicle to stay fit in the winter. And it went from there. And, you know, someone, you know, people were encouraging, because again, younger people coming into refereeing at that time, and the, you know, the rise was fairly steep.
But you were also lucky, I suppose, in the timing, in terms of the game was turning very professional at that stage, and the standard of refereeing needed to be professional, and there was a kind of a progress there going to happen.
Well, if you think back to 1990, which was the advent of the AIL, like when you think of now, Munster playing Leinster numerous times in games, full houses. I refereed Ulster versus Munster with 200 people at it in Ravenhill. The following week, I was doing Shannon and Young Munster in front of 9,000 people. Now, let me tell you, that was, you were on your mettle there. That was, you know, that was rivalries, that was parishes, that was, you know, it was completely different. But that's where rugby was at that time. It was very, very club-based. It wasn't interprovincial-based where it is now.
Switching to the business side of it, and as you said, you came back and you took over from your dad's business ultimately. Talk to me about that kind of intergenerational conflict that often goes from first generation to second generation, and you know, how did you make the decision? How did your dad make the decision that it was time to go?
Well, I had great admiration for him, not really realising till I was in my mid-20s the sacrifices and the risks that he had taken, because he had spent two-thirds of his working life in what was Royal and Sun Alliance, or what you'd know as RSA now. And when he was leaving, he left with nothing, because as you well know, within the great world's DB pensions, you got your own contributions back plus interest. Myself and my sister were at school. I didn't know that he didn't have the wherewithal or resources. It was really my mother who pushed him to do it. Oh, look at it. You know the old story, look at everyone else. But he was a very capable guy. And the other side of it was that probably wasn't encouraged, which I understood through his own childhood, that there was this untapped resource of a fellow who was hugely trusted, enormously popular, who probably didn't have a huge amount of confidence in himself. And probably more of my drive and direction came from, you know, my mother's side of the upbringing, and a very happy, loving home that probably I didn't realise didn't have a huge amount of resources, which would have been probably the same for most people growing up in that area. So I had great admiration for that. So I don't really know what he knew. I wanted to come into the business, but funnily enough, when I came back from Australia, I'd had a back injury and I was going to stay, and I worked for Norwich Union, a completely different organisation in many, many ways. But when I came back, my father kept pressing, well, when are you going to come back? If you're not going to come back, I was earning £25,000 at that time. Like, I was doing great. And here I was, and I was going to be paid effectively £8,000 a year. Like, what am I doing? 22 years of age. But I knew it was the right thing to do. And in simple terms, it was the rent, it was beers, put petrol in the car.
Yeah.
And here I was, I had no, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And I kind of had to say that to my dad. Like, he was saying, well, look, I've got like things like, I've got to pay you. And I'm going, why do you have to pay me? You know, you're one of my, you're like, you're my best buddy. I love you dearly, but like, this is now a business relation.
Yeah.
So, and I always remember, I said, listen, 50% of the first 1,000 and a third of the rest. And I'm filling in the red book every month to get paid. But it was a great lesson and a great exercise that, you know, you've got to fulfill your duties of what you're trying to do in terms of growing that. And again, hadn't really a clue. Mm. So I learned from a lot of friends along the way, people that were in the industry about basic dynamics of different laws, different things, studying, all those sorts of things. But I enjoyed the life business because it was a people business.
Yeah, people I do think forget that you know, we've had previous guests who said, look, I can hire anybody to do the technical, but I can't hire somebody who can't sell, right? And that's the key. And it's not that you're selling. I think selling sometimes gets a bad rap in the financial services sector. You're not boiler room selling. But what you actually have to be able to do is engage with the customer and get them to trust you and know that the outcomes are going to be good for them.
Well, it's no different to getting your hair cut, going into a gents retailer. If I'm going to go back to that retailer, did I really enjoy the fellow who sold to me? Yes, I did. I'll go back. And subliminally, I think, you know, in a sense, I had that. Mm. And I kind of knew I had that. But the great thing I had was I had time to actually do it. And really naively, to be perfectly frank with you. And I always, there was two things. I always remember going to a conference and the great Father Michael Cleary, would you believe that, stood up and he says, if you wouldn't buy this product yourself, you're a spoofer. And like, that lived with me because again, you probably remember back in the day, that was nearly the nature of the business. You were just flogging out product.
Stuff,
And you know, we can move on. The world has changed in terms of how we do those sorts of things now. And the industry is in a much, much better place. It's much more professional and it's much infinitely more enjoyable. But back then, it was kind of like that. And then after kind of 3 years, I was very lucky. My father had an accountant that dealt with him who was also, funnily enough, family. He was in the cricket club with us. Ian Kirk was his name. And he kind of really led me in a real kind of paternal way, because, you know, numbers, how we're going to do this, budgets, all this sort of stuff was alien to me in any real sense. And he was so good to me. And he was kind of said, look, Alan, with the way things are and where you're going, I think we might be better buying that life. Because the two companies, my father had a general commercial business, which is his and his partner's skill. And obviously, I was just doing the life end of the business. Why don't we buy it? And again, there was a negotiation with my father and his part. Anyway, it was bought and it was all done very handily. And now, in effect, I was my own boss of a very small company. But I was also a director of the general company. And then it came to the point, and I'm looking at it now, I'm 59 years of age, and I was going to my father at 59 saying, listen, Dad, what are you going to do? Well, I'd love to work 3 days a week and I'd like to do this. Well, look, what are you got? Are you going to sell the business? Mm. And he was kind of going, have you any interest in it? And in essence, I really had to pretend that I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I did have an interest because he had a business partner who retained 40% of the business. So in my own head, there could be an angle, oh, well, you're doing a sweetheart deal with your dad and then you're not being fair. So I, again, the gamble to the outside world was, I'm not interested. They went off and they found potentially a purchaser, and the non-family member went up the road and he said, there's no way we're selling to them. And I said, well, sure, look, I'll buy it for that price. Where will you get the money? Well, look, don't worry, we'll be able to get the money.
But at least it was clean in that there was a market price determined for it.
Absolutely.
And you knew then you were kind of above reproach in terms of the price that was going to be paid. Yeah.
And then the next learning aid was banks. Mm-hmm. So we had to go and raise half the capital. which was great fun back then. And my father and I, go down to NIB now, the manager down there, he's really good. I'm sure he'll really help.
Cool.
you know, the constraints on it. So that was my kind of first education in that. But it you know, in a sense, got me over the hill. And then I used 3 years of profitability to... My dad was very good to me then. He took the risk in saying, look, pay me on the drip, which you could do then. And he took that risk for the other 50% of the asset. And the other side for me was now I was, you know, in a situation where there was 10, 12 people in the office. You're not just, it's not just the money side. You're now managing 12
HR and they're managing a business.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, you mentioned something earlier on. You said that you kind of always thought that you'd like to work for yourself, right? There's lots of people out there that think that. And then when push comes to shove and they see how difficult it is to start your own business or even, you know, scale up an existing business that you've bought, you know, there's a whole series of skill sets that you don't have that you start realising I need to either gen myself up or find somebody who's really, really good and help me out.
Well, if you think back then as well, like, again, the world was the smaller broker's going to be squeezed out. We've got Direct Line. Everyone's going to go and get their motor insurance here, 123.ie. And again, the one side of the broking industry, they're a very resilient bunch. But the only thing we had to try and make sure at that stage was that, in a sense, we were small enough, which we wanted to do, to remain personal. Aidan, my number is 086, whatever it is. Phone me if you've got a problem. It's not 1-800-20-20-20. Which is it? And we always wanted to be that business, but small enough to be personal, big enough not to be bullied. And that was the next part of the journey, really, was in a sense. And again, came through sporting contact. I'm walking out of a cricket club with the then chairman of a committee, a fellow called David Williams. And I said, David, what are you doing with your business? Because again, they were similar to us. And he had a business partner who was 7 years his elder. And he said, funny, I was going to ask you the same question. Cup of coffee, long story later, in 2000, we merged and we brought the businesses together. And again, there was another very interesting story kind of within that in terms of, well, what's the value of your business? What's the value of your business? And we thought we better get someone independent to look at it, and who would we get that would be truly independent? Anyway, we won't mention the names, but the figure came back. Look, we'll do that job for you, but it'll cost 50 grand. Right. And David said, and he was actually the promoter of this particular person.
Right.
And I said, David, would it not be a lot better just to send the two accountants into a room for an hour?
Right. And let them bash it out.
And they bashed it, and they came out within 0.2% of one another. I said, you can have that. Let's get going. But we started with a clean sheet. And again, this is another part of the great exercise in terms of people. All his skills. Most of the skills he had, I didn't have in great abundance. And all the skills I had, he didn't have. And it was just a marriage made in heaven.
You raise an interesting point there about utilising your network, particularly in sport. You know, like you could argue an international network, but you also have a very strong Irish network. So how influential has that been in the business?
Well, it has been because, you know, again, going back to this piece about, you know, where do you enjoy doing business? How do you enjoy doing business? Probably the refereeing was the biggest part of that because Monday mornings were great fun. You know, if I had a European game on a Sunday, geez, that was some shambolic decision. But it was, you know, again, it was done in jest. And again, the people side of it was, I enjoyed all the people that we dealt with, by and large. And again, it was a great way of garnering business because they saw another side to you. I kind of think where you've got to be very careful to get that balance right. There's the sporting side and where they see, but the other side is when you go over the white line on a Monday to Friday, it's business. And you've got to be on your mettle because you'll be very quickly found out if you're not.
Would you fancy, as a complete aside, would you fancy being a referee now with all the TMO and everything? Would it be an easier or harder job?
I think it's lost its way a bit, to be perfectly frank with you. You know, the drug for me was decision making. And yes, there was areas when, let's call it TMO, came in. And I don't know. I've thought about it a lot, but in the context of where the game is now, let's say I knew I had this crutch that was up there all the time that, well, the TMO is there. Or, you know, you look at, subliminally, again, you will go, I know I'm saved. If there was no saviour for us in that world. You made decisions and you got on with them. And invariably what I learned was players generally, the little things, they didn't care about.
Yeah.
They don't care about it. It's the big things.
Yeah.
So when it came to things like positioning for try scoring, getting into the right position, working on doing things, working out who you're refereeing next week, who are going to be the big personalities, who are going to be the people that are going to be influential in how the game is going to run. And the other part about it is referees have now become front and central. And in any of my world, as my father used it, look, as long as you're not mentioned.
Yeah, you're out.
You know, in Stephen Jones's article, you know, you've had a pretty good game and just drift into the background. The game is about the players. Yeah, it isn't about the referee.
Yeah.
And probably in you know, everyone, Nigel is, in a sense, the messiah of that, and probably Nigel was great. Like, he was fantastic for the game. Not maybe the most technically proficient by his, and even I hope he possibly agrees, but he's on the farm now with his bulls and his cows and all those sorts of things. But people, and again, go back to this adage of why do business people do business? Rugby players liked him.
Yeah.
He was non-confrontational. He knew how to have a laugh at the right time. He knew how to come in and come out, and he entertained.
Yeah.
That's what he did.
But a lot of those skills, though, are quite transferable into running your own business rather than working for somebody, right? Being able to see the whole thing, get positioned right, be at the right thing, and ultimately the buck stops with you. You make a decision and you move on.
Mm. Well, people often ask me, what was the great... And I don't know whether you did, Aidan, but when you watch sport, you have heroes. Mm. And I suppose in my world in refereeing, like Derek Bevan was, in a sense, my hero. I had a great boss in the IRFU, you know, who pointed a direction, because there's points of travel when you're refereeing professional rugby, who, like Owen Doyle, he writes in the Irish Times, but he was very instrumental in strategic thinking. But the one thing that Derek Bevan, if I was to take it into business, he said, Alan, he says, prepare for the worst, he says, and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And it's so true. Mm. So, you know, if it's a tricky meeting, or you're talking about someone whose assets have dropped X pounds or whatnot, what are the facts? What are you going to discuss? Where are we going with this? And in effect, if you are prepared, often
it works.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. The when you when you took over the business from your dad, the had you it in your mind? Because, as you said, there was a series of mergers. There was consolidation going on within the industry. Was your dad kind of aligned in his thoughts of where it was going or what was have to do, or was there a very big new guard versus old guard type of first few years?
New guard versus old guard, totally. All dad wanted to do was whip over to the wishing well, have a couple of pints with his friends. And we called him TWT in the office, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He had long weekends every week. Actually, it was quite funny because I had to tell him, and again, it's one of those things in retirement, because he said, like, there's no way I can spend 5 days a week at home. That's not going to work. Well, I said, like, with this retirement relief thing, you know, I'm going to have to take, you're going to have to, listen, obviously your grey hairs, you're an influencer. You know, we're going to need some of your consultancy in terms of working on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So the likelihood is you'll be coming back.
Yeah.
I need to be coming back. So he obviously did come back. And then sadly, the one part of the piece, because I was at him, what are you going to do? So he sold his shareholding when he was 61. He sadly passed away when he was 69.
Okay.
And, you know, there's so many, in a sense, personal regrets in that with, you know, be it, and it was ironic because I would never have phoned him on a day before a match. And for some reason, I was doing Scotland against Australia in Hampden Park, and I rang him on the Friday. I never rang him on the Friday, ever. He'd often say, going off, good luck now in your match, and I'll be watching. Rang him on the Friday, and then I was driving to the game. My mother rang me to say, look, your dad's collapsed at home. And I said, crikey, oh, don't. And listen, I'll phone you. Anyway, at halftime, they knew he had passed away, and they didn't know what they were going to do. I was in the middle of the game and I ran back in, and obviously my wife told me dad had passed away. So it was very sad. But the other part in terms of reflection was that he had 8 great years. He travelled the world watching cricket, which so many people don't do if illness can get in the way. So, you know, never leave these things you know, too late is the adage, and you know you're in a world.
I have a client who has set himself up, done all his bits and pieces, and you know, taken care of his next generation, things like that. And he said, now he says, I have a pool of money to go and enjoy, and he says, and I want to make sure that the last check I write bounces, and that's it.
Well, the other one, of course, is if you don't travel business class, your kids will. And it is, and listen, I think the other side of it, if we look at our businesses over the course of those, and Ireland Inc. Mm. You know, it's become a very prosperous place. There's a lot of people. There's so many creative, great business people. And you're interviewing them in this series. I feel privileged that you're interviewing me, Aidan, in the company that you're keeping. But it's a story in itself because, you know, it is sport, it is business. And most of what you achieve at any stage of your life, it's often very self-fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sharing a story with people or how they think about certain, because loads of people have questions about different things. But I always love that mix of business and, because with the way the world's, and you were saying to me, gosh, would you referee? Well, it's full-time pro now.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of our era of where we had Alain Rolland, who did a World Cup final. I did the quarterfinal in the same year, and Donal Courtney as well, all involved in business. They'd never be refereeing now. Yeah. So you'd have lost 135 caps of history that wouldn't do the game. So that's my big question mark, particularly in Europe. Is there a necessary... I don't know what they do Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
Like people used to ask me, well, what's your... Well, I go to the gym 3 days a week. Because when you're doing game on game...
You've got to be fit yourself.
Well, the fitness comes... beforehand, you're only just topping up. In fact, in many cases, you're minding niggles.
Right.
And you're just getting prepared mentally. So Thursday night, I've got Leicester and, you know, Biarritz in I'm in Welford Road on Sunday. Who are the big matchups? I've got Martin Johnson as captain. I've got, you know, Harry Nordicke as the... I'd be much more strategic, psychological than, am I going to run around?
Yeah, yeah.
How am I going to deal with this situation? So they were the things that were more important. As
preparations, no different to running the business.
No, absolutely.
You know?
And being strict. Well, the business piece is always kind of forward planning. Mm. Where is the business going? And that was often the bit I enjoyed that more so, because we touched on it earlier around this business of, like, when we started, you just flogged product.
Yeah,
you know. And I always remember as well that, like, with two different pieces of paper, you could make $2,000, you made 500 quid.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
And it goes back to that Michael Cleary, if you wouldn't buy it yourself, you're a spoofer.
Yeah.
And it always resonated with me, that, because there's always a fair price for everything.
Yeah.
And if you can't articulate what a fair price is for the service you provide, you're a bluffer.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, with compliance, I find it's been like, some of it is way over the top. We know that. But there's certain areas, particularly with the intermediary space, where it's actually been very good.
Yeah.
Because you've got to justify what your existence is. And what is your existence? And ultimately, that's where this kind of, for us, planning became a big part of the focal point. The bits and pieces that lie around the edges are part and parcel of it.
LHW is the result of a few mergers and takeovers. Because we mentioned it earlier on, but what's the difference between establishing a company, your own company when you started off, and then when you start doing the mergers, trying to either optimise the culture between the two organisations or just move one organisation to the culture of the other?
Well, where we were fortunate was there's very few brokerages that do what was the general commercial insurance business and, like, let's call it life investment and pension planning. Very few did those. You were either one or the other. We were actually fortunate. We did both. From revenue point of view, we did both actually equally very well. So it made the validity of a purchase. So let's say we had a really good general practice with a limited life business with the clients that they had. That was a win.
Mm.
And again, talking about naivety, again, my account, Ian Kirk, would have been a big... I think we should purchase this business, and I think we should purchase that business. And again, often we had that, and I didn't even blink at the number. This might sound mad. Like, here we were buying a business for 1.2 million quid, and I'm kind of going, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. No, there was no, because I had this crutch beside me, which, and he, don't worry, we'll work. And listen, I understood the mechanics of, you know, in terms of payback on a business, a 5-year payback is a good, if we can do it in any period
earlier
than
better.
Clover. Yeah. And it was part of a strategy anyway, in terms of this becoming bigger, not to be bullied. Mm. And it was within a framework of what was suitable to our business, these two particular practices. And it worked really well. And for David, who had done a buy and sell agreement with me for 5 years, he was 57 at the time, he quadrupled his asset value in 5 years. So it was a beautiful finish and made me very happy that he exited. And he's still kicking on strong. He became chairman of Cricket Ireland at a time. And I only met him there last week. And he's still living the life fantastic in retirement. But he was a great influencer on me, David, a great man, full of integrity. And as I said to you, had all the ingredients in terms of how we changed the culture of the business, because we started with a clean sheet coupled with Graham Hone, which is the H of LH. It was Lewis Hone Williams. Graham Hone was in the business.
But ultimately, you did decide to focus the business, okay, and focus on the life and pension side of it. So how did you decide that the time you did it was the right time to do it? And what was the thought process around that decision?
Well, David exited at after his 5 years. And at that stage, there was a, you know, between where regulation and compliance was going on different sides of the business, I wasn't day-to-day involved in the commercial side of the business. And the idea really was, in my own head, I wanted to focus clearly on the financial planning, you know, the DB transfer type style, the various aspects of that business, and specialise in it. Because they'd clearly become two kind of separate disciplines. So the idea of selling the general business, and Graham was kind of anxious, and I had another shareholder on the life side, in Enda Bowen, who also felt that selling was, now that was the next part of the picture. Here was me buying these businesses, having deals done in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it was the most torturous process in the world. Now, was it the right place or time? Ideally, no. But it was a good time for me, because in many cases, people kind of other challenges. There was debt out there. There was different things that could be solved if it did happen. And it would fit in strategically with realistically where I wanted to go from the age of 49. And it worked out well, because there was a company called Lockton had come in. That fell on its backside. And a guy called Colm Kelleher came along and effectively, over time, bought the business, and he's away doing his end of the business, and we're doing ours now, and we have a nice tidy niche financial planning business with 8 employees, and you know, we have all the skill sets internally to drive that on, and that's what we've done.
You talk about staff, and I ask this question a lot to most people that come through here: hire talent or develop from within?
Two sides to that.
Okay.
So for argument's sake, I would have had defined benefit pension schemes. I have no hand, act, or part or the skill set to actually develop that side of the business myself. I understand the mechanics of what has to happen, but I needed a skill and an expertise. And I was at a function. I met this guy. He became his fellow director of mine, Morris McCann, had been working in Aon. He came to us in 2008 and, you know, since then, with some of the connections I had, we've transitioned maybe 8 defined benefit schemes into DB. And then the part of our role within it is to try and win the assets that are retained. Yes. And fortunately, we've been successful in that. And again, that sometimes comes from connections. I remember getting a phone call in one case from Danny McCoy and IBEC. You know, can you help me here? This is back in 2012, let's say, when margins were tight in a particular business and various different things. And I said, you know what, let's give it a go. Mercer are on the table, I dare say. The check they might have wanted for the transfer would have been a lot greater. Let's do it and let's see, can we win the war and win the battle for the assets, which we did. And it was probably one of my most enjoyable days in business, that one. That eventually came to fruition. But it was a 2-year process in that particular case, but we've done a number of them. But I had, that was a buy-in expertise. The other is from within. Mm. And yes, you garner from within because you garner with your culture. Mm. And again, bearing in mind what one had in the general business, and it's actually quite a funny story because in one particular case, a girl I'd employed when she was in the general business and had moved on with the business that was sold, I had a younger girl who left and, oh my God, what am I going to do? I got this phone call at 11 o'clock and I said, she said, I hear such and such is leaving. I know nothing about life and general business or life and investment business, but I'd love to work for you. I said, happy days. And I said, don't you, well, what about, we'll get it all educated, we'll get you doing it. Don't you worry, everything will be done. It's you. Mm. And she's gold.
It's that idea of you can teach people the technical side of it, but you can't teach people soft skills.
Absolutely. Mm. Well, you see, often, and there's a great saying, it's not what you say often, it's not what you do, it's how you make people feel. Mm. And that's what I want our organisation to be all the time. And, you know, they'll be in the... And by the way, sometimes you need disgruntled customers to keep you on your toes. Mm. I always say that's a good thing. Yeah. You know, if they're all blissfully... Not everyone is blissfully...
what's wrong.
No, you never know what's wrong. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes I want to know what's wrong because you... And to try and identify that and try and solve it. And then another lesson even within that, Aidan, I don't know whether you'd find is, you know, you could have someone on the phone belly aching down the phone. Give me 12 hours. Mm-hmm. Just give me 12 hours. I know you're paining, but I need to work it out. Yeah. And then by the time you ring them at 9 o'clock the following morning, the emotion is dragged out of the phone call. Yeah. So those just little things, because they're the things that happen in a people business. Yeah. But if you have the right people, and I'm very for, because there's two ways you can look. I've, you know, the staff, I don't even like that word staff. It's not, they're my friends, they're my colleagues. We spend 8 hours a day minimum with one another. Mm-hmm. You know, we just have good fun. Yeah. And, you know, you just do your work, do your business, and give them a feeling of part ownership and an incentive, you know, and bonus adds to that when you're speaking in the right way. And with the way the business is structured now, there's no necessity to actually even be worried about how that is actually, because you're doing it yourself.
You mentioned Eamon Walsh and Hibernian and the referee Derek Bevan, but who else have you learned? What have you learned from other executives or companies or other people?
Well, I suppose, you know, and again, God rightly, you know, he did have his woes, Sean Fitzpatrick, but I knew him personally, and again, walking around with him, he says, Alan, always employ people who are better than you are. I think that has always resonated with me, and I have people who are better than I am. I think my skill is, I hope, and I hope they'd probably agree, I have an ability to lead. I have an ability to garner, you know, let's not deal, but, you know, in terms of that, ingratiating yourself with other people, in being innovative, in taking the business to a new direction, that people buy into that. And I enjoy leading.
What advice would you give your younger self today, or just younger people in general?
Well, number one, which is a massive bugbear of mine, right? And it is absolutely dead set in it. Pick up the phone. It's a very simple act. You pick up the phone. I'm going to ask you a question, Aidan. I would love to know if someone would do a study on how much time is wasted on email. Good morning, Alan. We have a little problem with this case. Here's the issues. Half a minute.
Yeah.
Pick up the phone. We'll sort it out.
Well, and then, in your camp.
Are you in my own? Good. Well, I'm delighted someone's in my camp on that. So, you know, phone calls are for dealing with people. Emails are for facts. Mm. So further to our telephone call, here's what we agreed. Matter closed. I will do this or we will do that, and off you go. So that would be one of the things that I push my own children and pick up the phone, no matter what you want to do. And anyone I talk to in bigger business, actually, some friends of mine in some of the bigger accountancy firms, they're tearing their hair out. Mm-hmm. Tearing their hair out with people who won't pick up the phone. Now, I don't necessarily kind of think remote working hasn't helped. Mm. But I think the first business, and I'm talking, let's even our suppliers, the insurers that we deal with, that actually develop a world for themselves that technologically enabled personal businesses, they could fly. Mm. They could absolutely fly and encourage people to do that. But what they're saying to us is young people won't pick up the phone. I'll text you. Yeah. And as you well know, it just when you start spilling emotion onto an email or a text, good luck.
Yeah. To what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you?
Not really. I don't think fearing failure. I was always of the mindset, you know, if you work hard. I was a talented cricketer. There was people more talented than me, but I worked very hard at most of the skills that I did. You're never going to be. It's never going to be utopia. You're never going to have the perfect game. But I always kind of sensed if I worked harder than the guy next to me, I do, and smart. Like, I think in business, there's all this business about you can spend 12, 13 hours in an office.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just don't buy that rubbish. You know, give me a high quality 8 hours. And when you leave at 6 o'clock or whatever time you do, go and do something else.
Yeah.
Go and do something else that's going to inspire you, that you feel good the next day you come in. You know what I mean? Because there's more to life than that. So, you know, I would very much encourage that.
And then following on from that, so what do you think, what percentage of your success is down to luck and what's down to hard work?
Oh, you need luck. Oh, no. Oh, no. And let me give you a very clear example. I'm driving 2001, I think it is. And it's in this sway of referee, this, that, and the other. So I'm driving to the airport. I'm touch judging for France versus Wales. I get a phone call from World Rugby to say, Dave McHugh, the referee's gone down. He's collapsed. He's not. You are doing the game tomorrow. Right? And funny enough, back then I rang my father at the time. I said, listen, don't tell a soul, but this is happening.
Well, I'm
front and centre, you see. It was one of the great games ever. 8-try fest. Wales beat France in France for the first time in 25 years. It was a one, and the French are really funny, right?
Yeah.
The French, if it's a really good game, Stade de France, they don't care. Très bon match, Monsieur Labbé, très bon match. That's all they care. If they won 9-8 in a big scowls in their faces, all this stuff. That's luck.
Mm.
And then the other one was I did a game. I was meant to do Australia, Italy, and then same type of thing. You're going on a 3-week, you're doing South Africa, France. And again, it was another 8-try feast, 27 all. And at that stage, because my career kind of wavered a bit. And it's funny because if you kind of think of fear of failure, I hated being second best, maybe. And I actually went to my boss after, Owen Doyle, after maybe 10 internationals. I'm plateauing here. It's, you know, where are we going?
Mm.
You know, can you shoot me with every bullet you've got in the gun? I don't want no bullshit, really. Just give it to me straight. Okay, he said, fair enough. And it ended up with me going to meet a guy, because sometimes when you're in that world, you can, do you ever notice it? And it can happen in business too. People, oh, I wonder what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, instead of actually concentrating on what you're doing yourself. And that was a huge turning point. But I went to see this psychologist and I'm driving. Can you believe this? Right, I'm driving up the Stourgan Road. I'm going into St. John of God's. I said, I'm not a basketball, but I met a great guy, Morrissey, there. But he compartmentalized things because he made a great statement to me. He said, when the human mind is under pressure, it does silly things. And it's a great line. And you can apply it to business. You can apply it to anything.
Anything, yeah.
Taking that little bit of time, but having bits ready. And I just compartmentalized that type of thing. And then we watched a game and I remember it vividly. I was watching it with my wife and, you know, the Owen Doyle, it was a video game. Oh, he tore strips. And she's going, oh, hey, he's right. What are you talking? That's nonsense you're talking. What are you talking about? And again, once we got all of that sort of stuff cleared up, he described that then as the watershed moment. Let's move on.
Right.
And there was a kind of a pivotal game, New Zealand, England. It was a centenary game at Twickenham. And it was, I knew in my own head, it was kind of, this is sink or swim. You're either going to go that way
or
you're going to go that way. And look, it was a funny game because there was yellow cards in it against New Zealand. New Zealand won. And it's not often they jump up and down when they win a test, like a test match, but they jumped up and down because it was just, it was attritional. England were attritional, and it went for me. And the press the following day was, you know, the English press, at last there's a referee who's taking on these the cynicism of, you know, the All Blacks, blah, blah, blah. And then the other side was dealing with the All Blacks moving forward. And that was another, that was another talk of preparation.
We'll stick in the sport one for a second. Okay. I'll be interested to know in this one. Who is the best cricketer and rugby player you've ever seen? And the second part is, who is the hardest rugby player you've ever refereed?
Dear oh me.
And that's not even the black book question.
The best cricketer, that's it. That's it. There was cricketers you see I admired. I admired technicians, and these names, Rahul Dravid is an example. They called him the Wall, an Indian batsman, just technical brilliance. Probably in terms of box office, and I always remember Richie Beno saying, if you walked into a ground and Brian Lara was in his pomp, I'll never forget his innings in Antigua when he basically beat the Australians single-handedly. But he was a showman. Yeah. He just had a technique and a fashion of playing all on his own. He was beautiful to watch. Mm. And there your ear is. The other one in terms of, like, my house is named after a fellow called Desmond Haynes. Because back when I was 80, like, the West Indies were the dream. Viv Richards, all those sorts of things. Curtly Ambrose. My house is named after Desmond Haynes. It's mad. It's known as Haynesville, which is a little suburb in Barbados, where he's from. Rugby player, interesting. I was a kind of a brain over brawn rugby players that, like, let me give you an example, and this is kind of left field. Yannick Jauzion, that played for France in the early 2000s, beautiful rugby player, just knew where to be at a given point in time. Captain, you can say what you like about him, but he was brilliant, Martin Johnson. Mm-hmm. And it's mad, really, to think that, you know, what happened to him as a coach happened to him. But on the field, you know, the ability in a nutritional game like rugby to... And I used to, I remember as well, actually, there's one test match where they went down to England. England had to go to Australia and New Zealand in 2003. And they felt they had to win there if they wanted to win the World Cup. Cut a long story short, two of them were yellow carded inside 30 minutes. And New Zealand said, "We'll have a scrum, please." And I remember going over to that Steve Thompson saying, Tomo, just go down, go fucking down. He says, "He's not going to put three of us in the bin." Wasted 5 minutes. Free kick out to England. Lawrence Dallaglio back, or Neil back on the field. Masterclass.
Yeah.
No whinging and moaning. He was straight in. Like, that's proper leadership. Like, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And of course, he was right, because there's no way the referee was going to put another one in the bin. He was great. There was some great kind of mercurial talent.
Toughest to referee, though.
I singling out, everyone has this thing about Richie McCaw.
Yeah.
Like, and I can see your eyes, right? I can see your eyes.
Yeah.
But they were so clever.
Yeah.
They were clever.
I have to respect them for how clever they were.
Yeah. But you always knew they were taking, like, back row forwards, it's a 60-40 game.
Mm.
Like, if I get to 50-50, there'll be times.
Yeah.
But one of the great players of that era within that, because they're most of the people you'd be, a fellow called Martin Williams from Wales, short in stature, so clever. And they were the people, because rugby often doesn't come around to who are the bright guys in terms of making these, because it's all boot, bollock and bite. Well, it isn't.
Mm.
Rugby often isn't. And that's why those type of players always kind of stood out for me. And, you know, McCaw, I think, got branded because that's the way they were. They had a 92% win record between World Cups, I might add. But, you would point to him. But I had great admiration for him. I didn't really have too much fuss with him. There was a fellow who was difficult that played for France, Olivier Azam, tricky customer. French, if they went against you, they weren't pleasant people.
Do you obsess about the small things within the business?
No.
No.
No. Small things. There's battles and there's wars, Aidan. I think what you've got to do is show focus on where you want to go and what you want to do. And that's probably the next passage for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably coming at a stage, funnily enough, when I've never enjoyed the business as much as I enjoy it now, more because of the path the business has taken as a profession.
Mm.
As a profession. You know, we sat down there and talked about it a number of years ago, and a client came in And a very good client and an executive type client came in with his wife, and he said he entered the business financially apprehensive. He left with peace of mind. He said he had freedom to live. Mm. And I just latched onto that. So that's the strap line that we, it's LHW, freedom to live now. And you can laugh about it or you don't laugh about it, but it's catchy. Yeah. But if you actually ask people, what does it mean? Because often what we're finding now with this planning piece is they people actually realise they don't need as much. Mm. You know, generally speaking, if one factor, if people are debt-free, life can be quite easy if you have income. Yeah. And in many cases, all their when they see this sort of thing mapped out, it's nearly like, honestly, and often if you have a husband and a spouse or a partnership or whatever it is, when they're both there, it is very, very fascinating to see the response that they don't really know.
Now comes the hard part.
Oh, no.
Referee looking into the...
This is the bit I fear. Right.
Okay.
Your facial expression is doing it for me here.
Where in the world gave you the most satisfaction, from a business sense if you want, and where would you like to go next?
I would have to say I really enjoyed the business time that I had in Australia, and I'll tell you why, because I ended up in the first instance, two stories that I'll tell you. I worked for an insurance company called Alexander & Alexander, and what I learned about Australians were they weren't the most industrious in the world, because when I went past the secretary's desk after 2 months, she said, "Alan, can I have a word, please? Mm-hmm. We're a bit concerned about you. You haven't taken a sickie yet." And I thought, wow. So I took this sickie on a Tuesday. So I rang, I said, "Mitch, yeah, I'm a bit under the weather today." "Yeah, it's all right, Alan. You just take it easy today," she said. So I'm down in Royal Sydney Golf and I just didn't feel good. I just didn't feel good. But then when I came back, we had a tour to Zimbabwe. I came back and this guy who had been in the club, father of a son, north of England, who'd made it good in Australia. He said, "Come and meet me. I want to see you," he says. And I worked for this guy and I watched an artist at work in his office, 22181, a fellow called Ray Gallion. Sadly, he was a bit of an alcoholic. And he'd so I was learning all about... Because he sat in the middle, he would have done a lot of work for the State Rail Authority, and his business partner kind of put the deals together. But you know, he'd be saying, "Listen, pick me up in Avalon in the morning. I'm driving out of this place, 21 years of age, across Sydney Harbour Bridge in a Jaguar XJS, thinking what's wrong with life." But Australia was a great experience. Into the future, I love France. I love South Africa in particular. I love sad in so many ways, but what a country. Mm-hmm. What a country. So I'd like to think in time I'll spend more time. My daughter plays international cricket, so we've followed her a bit.
Man somewhere.
Well, no, I was a bit at the forefront because obviously when you're involved in cricket, but I've learned to stay. She thinks I'm actually much better now. I've learned to stand back a bit, and she's far better than I ever was. So it's much easier. So we travel with that as a family.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Alan Lewis, for joining me today. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, or comment if you enjoy what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning. The information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. Janie Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Janie Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.